Andrew Pudua is the director of the Institute for Excellence in Writing. He lives in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He's the husband of Robin, father of 7, grandfather of 11, with more coming very soon. Traveling and speaking around the world, he addresses issues related to teaching, writing, thinking, spelling, and music with clarity, insight, practical experience, and humor. My sons love his jokes. His seminars for parents, students, and teachers have helped transform many a reluctant writer and have equipped educators with powerful tools to dramatically improve student skills. I had the pleasure of taking my 2 oldest children to his writing workshops in 2018 on the other side of the state. And it was a long drive, and I thought they might complain. They didn't. They loved it, and they told me, my 6-year-old told me, I had to bring Mr. Pudua to Spokane. We did. Thank you, Asher. So although he has many high accolades, his best endorsement to date is from a young Alaskan boy who called him the funny man with the wonderful words. Please welcome with me Andrew Pudua.
Thank you. Yes, I hope so. It's good to be back where it's cloudy and cool. So, I did not grow up in a Christian home. Occasionally, my mother would haul us in, I don't know, a few times a year to Mount Olive Lutheran Church, I think out of a sense of guilt. And I had no idea what was going on there. There was no catechism. It was just you'd go and sing a few songs and be bored for a while. And then our family religion actually was sailing. My father, an engineer, worked to live and lived to sail. So whenever the weather was good, which was about almost all the time in Los Angeles, we would be out on the boat on the weekends. And so as a teenager, I had curiosity and a car and a desire to know. And this led me into bookstores and Eastern religions and New Age thinking. And I actually dropped out of college and joined a New Age cult and worked there for a couple years. And I was very deep into this New Age until a life crisis when I was around 35. And it hadn't worked, the whole New Age thing. But I was very attached to it. And I kind of then just threw myself at God and said, okay, I don't know who you are. I don't even know if I like you. But change me or kill me. And that began a conversion, a slow conversion process by which I found Jesus and the gospel and life and joy and a complete transformation. And when I hit 50, a few things happened all at once, kind of dramatic. The first thing is my first biological grandchild was born, and that's a really interesting thing that happens. If it hasn't happened to you yet, it changes your whole world. Rather than what's good for me right now and my children, is what kind of world am I leaving for these? The other thing is I had this painfully acute realization that my life was definitely half over. You know, and I was flooded with gratitude for my faith because I look at people and I think, how do you live without God? How do you survive being human without the assistance of a relationship with Christ and the Holy Spirit? I wouldn't want to do it. And I had this profound gratitude, and it caused me to reflect on my life and think, what was it that helped me escape the New Agey lies and find the capital T truth? And I figured out two things from my childhood. One is I spend a tremendous amount of time in nature, a lot of it in solitude in nature, on mountains, in the middle of oceans, underwater, climbing rocks. I spent so much time, and I think that planted deep inside me this God's first book, nature. And so when I found the need for the gospel, my soul responded. So I wrote a talk about that called Nature Deficit Disorder. I stole the title from a guy who wrote a book called Nature Deficit Disorder. And then the other thing that struck me was I grew up, I don't remember school. I don't remember what I read in school. I honestly have so few memories of anything that happened in schools. Everything of significance happened before or after or outside of school. And what did I read? I don't remember what I read in school, but I do know at home I basically just read again and again Lord of the Rings, the complete books of fairy tales, and the World Book Encyclopedia. That was my education. So I had this experience, a very strange experience. I travel a lot, so I end up in many different churches. And I was in a church waiting for things to happen. And this church had a lot of banners on the wall, all around the sides. And I was looking at this banner, and it said, Christ the King. It was kind of an ugly banner. But it, nevertheless, it had these words. And I remember sitting there looking at that, going through a very interesting series of emotions, thoughts and emotions. My first reaction to that banner was, I don't like that idea. And then I felt guilty for not liking that idea. Like, I'm a Christian. I should like the idea, Christ the King. But I don't. Why? Right? Because I thought if I could figure out why I don't like it, I could solve it, and then I wouldn't feel guilty anymore. Right? And I thought, well, I am an American. I was educated in American public schools. I am infiltrated by Americanism. And our whole country was founded on the very idea of get rid of a king. Right? Kings are bad. They are de facto wrong. And the march of progress is you depose kings and replace them with democracy. And that's what's right. And I thought, that is phenomenally weird that being in America is interfering with my Christianity. And I thought, well, that's not so strange after all. But then I sat there a while longer and I thought, hold on a minute. At a much deeper level, I love that idea. I actually love the idea of kings. In fact, secretly, in the corner of my heart, I would like to live in a monarchy. I would almost, if I were free to do so, move to Monaco or somewhere that still has a king. I mean, I'd even be happy as an honorary Canadian and having a queen. But we have nothing of this sort, and I resent that. So then I felt guilty about liking kings, but then I realized, no, why do I like this idea of kings? And then it all flashed on me. Fairy tales. You see, fairy tales contain the truth of kingness. The truth about kings is that kings should love and make sacrifices for their people, and the people should love and make sacrifices for their king. That is the truth of kingness. Only you don't generally extract that truth from history books. In fact, in a lot of history, you focus on the bad kings who did bad things. There were some good ones, but mostly you think about the bad ones. Even in the Bible, a lot of the kings weren't very good. And so I thought, wow, I have not consciously learned the truth, but I have subconsciously learned the truth of kingness, which allows me to love Christ the King with my heart. I learned it from fairy tales. Because in fairy tales, that's the way it is, right? And the kings are good, and they love their people. And if there is a bad king in a fairy tale, he is to be deposed, yes, but not replaced with a democracy. He is replaced with the true king. And this moment, sitting in that church, caused me to become very, very curious and interested in the study of fairy tales. So I bought a bunch of books and I started to read them, both secular and Christian authors. And I came to the conclusion, I think there's more truth, capital T, truth, contained in fairy tales and literature than there is in history books. History books are always written by someone with an agenda. You may agree or disagree with their agenda, but you weren't there. They weren't there, in most cases. You can read autobiographies, but even people who write autobiographies have agendas, like Winston Churchill. He said, "History will be kind to me. I intend to write it." So I started to just be fascinating with this idea, and one of the first things I came across, and I will recommend a few things. I think you have a little bibliography in your booklet there, so if you don't catch all the titles, I've written them down for you. The first thing I came across was G.K. Chesterton. Any Chesterton fans out there? This is a classical conference. Every hand should be in the air. What's wrong with you? Anyway, Chesterton, in his book Orthodoxy, had a chapter entitled The Ethics of Elfland. And you don't have to buy this. You can read it free on the internet. And it's a great essay. And like most of Chesterton, you read a few sentences, you stop, you think, you chew on it, you read it again. But one of the observations he makes is he says, we don't read fairy tales to children so that they learn dragons exist. Children already know that dragons exist. We read them fairy tales so that they can learn dragons can be slain. He said in Ethics of Elfland, we like astonishing tales because they touch the nerve of the ancient instinct to astonishment. And he talks a lot about this idea of wonder and how the supernatural story cultivates that awe, that wonder. He also points out some interesting things. He points out that there are truths contained in many fairy stories that are very important for children to learn. One of those, particularly important for girls, is that frogs can be princes, or sometimes princes can turn out to be frogs. We learn that the innocent are blessed. The Beatitudes are deeply steeped, right? The fairy tales are deeply steeped in the Beatitudes and the Christian mysteries. And one of the interesting objections to fairy tales, in fact, there are some people who are very anti. It's called the Cinderella syndrome. It's like, we shouldn't read this story to children because it's a lie. Nobody lives happily ever after. Life is full of misery and pain, and you just set up children for disappointment when you read them stupid things like, they lived happily ever after. But you see, that's a distinctly atheistic perspective, isn't it? I mean, if you're a Christian, if you have any sense of the supernatural, even if you're not a Christian, there is a penetrating belief of the afterlife. We do live forever. And we can live happily forever. Not necessarily in this life, in this life as happy as we would wish, but if we follow the right path and make the right sacrifices, we can expect eternal happiness. That's why the stories end that way. True love, another criticism. Oh, you read children's stories like Cinderella and they're going to believe they'll find their true love. Well, nobody really does. And you just set them up for disappointment. Well, maybe you will, maybe you won't, but there's always Jesus Christ, the lover of your soul, the spouse of the church. That's the analogy. Ethel Pachocki wrote a book called Once Upon a Time Saints. And she made this statement. I think it's worth quoting directly. She said, fairy talks clear the way for sanctity. They are the child's first morality play. Clear cut, no nonsense, black and white, good and evil, life and death. With a bit of fun thrown in to alleviate the pain. And so I continued to read all about these fairy tales, and I realized this is a hard time to be a parent and navigate the world of children's books and navigate almost all modern literature, because we've lost that sense as a culture that children need, what Ethel said, that first morality play, that clear-cut idea. So I was listening to a talk by a friend of mine, Oliver DeMille, and he outlined kind of a way of thinking about literature that I found particularly helpful as a parent, as a teacher. So I'm going to share that with you. I don't know that he wrote this down anywhere, and I heard him say it, and then I've kind of developed my own way of presenting it. But he pointed out there are four basic types of stories, four types. Whole, as in complete. Healing, broken, and twisted. And this became, for me, a good filter to help understand literature. Now, of course, there are some hybrids. There are stories that are a combination of these. But if you think about them individually, it gives you an analytical tool. So let's go over briefly and think about this. Whole, healing, broken, and twisted. Whole stories are the type where good is good, bad is bad. It's clear as day, and good wins. We need these stories. Children need these stories. One of the oldest and probably most prevalent versions of a whole story would be Cinderella. You find that story in one form or another in almost every culture, where there's innocent good that is oppressed, and then the innocence and goodness is rewarded, and the evil is punished. Now, if you're going to read Cinderella, however, to boys, you need to get the right version. Because some of the fairy tales, which were originally written to be boy-friendly, are considered a bit too violent for the modern child. So you have to go back and get the old version. Because in the old version of Cinderella, you know, when the emissary of the prince shows up with the slipper and tries to fit it on the stepsisters, well, the first stepsister, in order to fit into the slipper, cuts off her toe. And the blood oozes out of the slipper, thereby exposing her as a fraud. Then the other stepsister, in order to fit her big ugly foot into the slipper, cuts off a portion of her heel. And the blood oozes out of the slipper, thus exposing her as a fraud. And the emissary of the prince says, ha ha, you are frauds, there's got to be another girl around here somewhere. Which raises the question, why would she put her foot in this blood-soaked slipper? But nevertheless, you have to suspend common sense many times. Let me tell you the plot of a movie. I'm going to tell you exactly the plot of this movie, and then I want you to figure out if you know what this movie is. It came out, I would guess, maybe 8 years ago. So here's the plot. Evil arises. A reluctant savior appears. The savior is captured, sent literally to the pit. Evil dominates. The savior almost miraculously rises up out of the pit, defeats the evil, order is restored, and the Savior disappears. Do you know what movie this is? The Return of the Dark Knight. Batman. Batman returns. That's the whole plot of the movie right there. Why do people do this? Why do they go to movie after movie after movie with the same plot? Because it is the story. And the producer of that movie knew exactly what he was doing. He knew it was an allusion to the story of humanity. In fact, it's interesting. I think that the reason superheroes were born in America and became popular as America spewed it out to the rest of the world is because we lost, as Protestant Calvinist origins of America, we lost the cult of saints, the cult of the saints. We lost that idea of supernatural, of superpowered people, right? I mean, and even Protestant Europe, even Lutheran and Anglican tradition, there were this awareness, at least, of saints. But we didn't have that. And so children grew up in a vacuum of no supernatural role models. So what had to happen? We had to idolize something. Superheroes and sports stars. Because I've been very fascinated with why do these teenagers in particular just devour passionately these superhero movies. We want to be reminded the whole story is this. Good wins in the end, and it's a supernatural victory. Healing stories are stories where good is good, bad is bad, and good doesn't win in the way you would expect. But there is redemption. These are redemptive stories. Probably the master of the healing story is Hans Christian Andersen. His stories are so steeped in beauty and gospel truths and supernatural. And he describes stories entering his mind fully formed. Almost the way Handel described the Messiah entering his consciousness. Or Bach saying, God writes the music, I just scribble notes, right? So, The Little Mermaid. I hope you've read the actual version. You must. If you haven't read this story, it's not so long, about 17 pages. And you should read it immediately to disabuse yourself of the Disney perversion of it. Because it's totally distorted. It's not even the same story. See, in the real Cinderella, the original, she doesn't get the prince. In fact, here's what happens. She gets old enough to pop her head above the ocean, and she decides that she wants to go above the ocean. She sees this prince. She falls in love with him. And so she goes to the sea witch, and she trades her tongue. Cuts out her tongue for the power to have legs and walk on land. Now that right there would have been improvement to the movie because it would have saved us from a lot of bad music. But you see, it's critical. It's critical to the plot. You see, she goes on land. She saves this prince, right? And she falls in love with this prince. She also knows somehow that as a mermaid, she will live for 300 years and then dissolve into foam on the sea. But if she marries a human, she will join her soul to his soul, and she will attain an immortal soul. And so she's half motivated by love, but even more motivated in a way to become fully human through a sacramental means. So anyway, she hangs out with the prince for a while. He keeps her around because she's kind of cute and a pet, but he falls in love with this other girl. She can't tell him that she loves him because no tongue. And the story progresses on. Now she's spent so much time out of water walking around. And by the way, walking around was tremendously painful for her. Anderson describes it as every step she took was like knives cutting into the soles of her feet. It reaches a point where she's past the point of no return. If she doesn't marry the prince, if he marries someone else, she will never be able to marry him. And at that point, she cannot return to being a mermaid. She will dissolve into foam on the ocean and cease to exist. So her sisters go to the sea witch. And they bargain. They trade their hair. I'm not sure what the significance of that is. They trade their hair for a knife. And they take this special magical knife. And they see her on this boat where she is with the prince and the girl he's marrying. And they said, if you will plunge this knife into the heart of the prince and drip the blood on your feet, you can change back into a mermaid and live out your 300 years. And if you don't, you dissolve into foam on the morning after the wedding. So they get married, they're sleeping. She looks at him and she says, can't do it. I cannot. I love him too much. I would prefer my own annihilation. And so she throws the knife into the water. The sun peeps over the horizon, and she begins to dissolve into foam. But the invisible spirits of the air, who've been watching this whole thing, come and swoop her up and say to her, because you have made this great sacrificial act of true, pure love, you have earned the privilege, the opportunity to serve with us, invisible spirits of the air. And if you do so diligently and faithfully for 300 years, you will attain an immortal soul. Whoa! What if Disney had made that movie? There's another story, and I'll tell you something else that happens if you turn 50, especially you young guys who are all tough. You start crying a lot more. I don't know what it is, but man, I started crying about all sorts of things. I never would have shed a tear when I was tough. So I can't actually read this story anymore because by the time I get to the end, I'm just like, I can't even see it. But you're probably familiar. It's a little match seller. Do you know the story? Oh, it's just. So there's this little girl. She's probably, what, I don't know, 6, 7, innocent, poor, poor child, not a coat, this old, awful pair of shoes, and she's sent out to sell matches. And it's middle of winter, like New Year's Eve or something, and she's holding the matches, and everybody's busy, busy, busy. Nobody's buying a match. And she loses a shoe, and a mean boy steals another shoe, and she's freezing, but she can't go home without selling matches or she'll be beaten. And she just succumbs to the temptation to light one little match one time just for a moment of warmth because she's so cold. And as she lights the match, the wall beside her becomes a bit translucent. And then she lights another match and another match. And she lights all the matches and the wall becomes completely transparent and she sees essentially the beatific vision. She sees the brilliance and the angels and her grandmother welcoming her to it. And then the last paragraph, they find her body frozen, stiff as a board against the wall. <It's> like, he killed her! He killed this innocent child! Why would you read this to anyone? That's not what it's about. It's about the truth with the capital T. She had a horrible life and she died. And guess what? We're all going to die. But there is the other side of the wall. There is the beauty of eternity. It's a healing story. There's another one. I'm not even going to tell you the story because I'll cry as soon as I start. But it's also by Anderson. It's called The Jewish Maiden. Go read it. Definitely one of the most important books in our house, maybe still is, was The Complete Hans Christian Andersen. So many incredible stories. So we need these healing stories because guess what? Bad things happen, right? And it's easy to despair sometimes, is it not? People you know or love have terrible things happen, or you have something terrible happen, or you suffer. We have to have faith that it comes out right in the end, that there is redemption and there is healing and it will happen. The next type of story is broken. Broken stories are stories where good is good, bad is bad, and bad wins. Now, these are kind of a bit dangerous of stories, and you certainly don't want to read them to children too young. Probably a broken story that most of you are familiar with. Many of us of my generation were forced to read this in high school, Lord of the Flies. It's just a broken story. Nothing good happens, right? So what's the value? Another one, which is much more artistically done and valuable, but still very broken, is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Why did Stevenson write that? It's funny. I remember this moment when my son didn't read a book till he was 12 years old. And I will mention, the first book he actually read was The Wilder King. So that got him going. But he was extremely dyslexic. However, I loaded him up with audiobooks. He listened 6, 7, 8, 9 hours a day to audiobooks for about for me it was like 6 to 12 years old. That's all he ever did. And so it was interesting because I was sitting on the couch with a 15-year-old teenage girl reading Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, doing it right. We had two copies. We were annotating, stopping to discuss, reading back and forth, right? And he walks in and he says, "What are you guys reading?" And I said, "Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Stevenson." And he said, "Oh, I read that. I hated it." He's 10 years old. I said, "What did you just say?" He said, "Well, I read that and I hated it." I said, "You don't read." He said, "Well, I listened to it. What's the difference?" Which is true. I mean, right? I mean, I will actually tell someone I read a book when the truth is I listened to it. Same thing, really. But anyway, I said, "Okay, how did that get on your iPod?" I don't even know. But anyway, I was curious. So I said, "Why did you not like it?" And he said, "Nothing good happens. It just gets worse and worse and worse and worse until the only way out is death." Right? It's a horribly broken story, but it's valuable. Because in those stories, you must inject yourself into the story and say, "What could I have done differently?" Right? That's the moral imagination. You put yourself on the island with those boys in Lord of the Flies. And you're like, "If I had been there, could I, would I, should I have been able to do something differently?" Do you see? And of course, Hyde, Jekyll and Hyde is a story that's very valuable and important for every teenager, because every single person is going to have to wrestle with problems of addiction and lust for power or whatever. And you see outpictured there in glorious ugliness the result of succumbing to that. And you learn from it. So the broken stories are useful, but they should not be read to young children. And they also need to be read with the proper discussion. Because if you don't have the right conversation, then the story can become very negative. That's why for him, to listen to that story at 10 years old was a very bad thing. And it was a mistake I somehow made accidentally. And he still hates the story. The last genre is twisted. Twisted stories are where good is portrayed as not good or evil, and or evil is portrayed as good. It's essentially the glorification of evil. There's not a lot of this until the modern time. This type of story had no value to a Christian culture, so people didn't really want it. Probably the first one that got any real traction was in the 1900s, the book Clockwork Orange, where you really saw this complete twisting in perception, right? I'm not proud of the fact, but when I was a teenager with a car and very little parental supervision, I used to go down to the theater at the beach midnight, Saturday, week after week, month after month, for a couple of years, and watch the same blasted movie. You know what I'm talking about. The Rocky Horror Picture Show, which is completely twisted, right? Any goodness is portrayed as stupid, and the evil is glorified. And because it's this catchy musical comedy thing, it gets deep into your brain. And it's hard to pull that stuff out, right? But now what we see is a mixing of these genres. And it's tough because people today think that, well, you know, there's no actual absolute good. There's no actual absolute evil. Real life isn't full of that. The story should be more realistic. What we really just have is 50 shades of gray, right? Which would be the ultimate confusion element that happens. So what you'll often find is you'll find a story that seems whole but apparently has twisted elements. There are some TV shows that are extremely subtle and very powerful. So if you look at, say, Breaking Bad, this is tremendously good. It is as broken as a story gets. It is succumbing to the evil and the ultimate end. This is the great epic tragedy of the age. Look at a show like House of Cards. You can't not end up rooting for this evil person because he's twisted, right? His evil isn't really evil, and it sucks you in evilly. It's very challenging. Probably safest to stay away from TV shows, but you've got better things to do with your time. But, you know, examples in the culture. So we see the problem now is this twisting, and one of the most common things that's being twisted is the archetypes. So on your bibliography down at the bottom, there is a book called Landscape with Dragons. I highly recommend this book. It's by Michael O'Brien. I would consider him one of the best living Christian authors today. His book, Father Elijah, Eclipse of the Sun, post-apocalyptic fiction, it's some of the best stuff I have ever read. But this nonfiction book, Landscape with Dragons, talks about the twisting of archetypes. He starts, of course, with the most commonly twisted archetype, that of the dragon. So think for a moment about dragons. Throughout most of the history of Western civilization and even ancient civilization, what did a dragon represent? Yeah, the evil one, right? Satan, who wants to destroy your soul, to eat your children, to condemn you to a life of eternal suffering. I don't know when it started, possibly with this song. Puff the magic dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Hanalei. Now, that song may or may not be about marijuana. People have been debating that since I was a child. But we do know one thing. Dragons don't frolic. Dragons emerge from their lair with wrath and hatred of mankind, and burn whole cities, and must be killed. But now, you see, this trend has come to the point where dragons are, you know, in the world of McCaffrey and who's that kid, homeschooling kid, Aragon, right, series. They're neutral. Dragons are just neutral. You make them good or evil. And then, of course, you get to the point where you can actually just train your dragon. Now, I'm not saying that's all disordered, but what he's pointing out is that this is messing with a deep level archetype in the psyche of all of us. Okay, so what happened next? Well, wizards. That's a tough one, right? Witches and wizards, because technically, you know, witches are evil and they should be killed. But then you have good witches. Like, you know, there's the Wicked Witch of the West, but then there's the Good Witch of the North. And of course, we have wizards. Tolkien put wizards in. I mean, Moses was kind of like the first wizard, right? Would you have loved to be there? He comes in, and the magicians of the Pharaoh throw their staff down and turn into snakes. And he throws his staff down and turns into a snake and eats their snakes and turns back into his staff. Would you love to see that? But see, what's the difference? Why is Moses' magic licit and Pharaoh's isn't? That's the question. Because God told Moses. So, I don't like to go deep into Harry Potter stuff, but I will make a quick observation. Do I have to end right now at 11? Sooner or later? Sooner better than later? Just a quick observation about a difference between, say, the worlds of Tolkien and Lewis, like Middle Earth versus the worlds of Harry Potter, right? And for the most part, you look at Harry Potter stories and say they're very whole, good winds, and there's even a theologian, Orthodox theologian, who wrote Finding God in Harry Potter or something, right? But here's one difference. In Tolkien's world, only the supernatural archetypes use magic. Gandalf, elves. They are archetypes of angelic supernatural assistance. The normal people, men and hobbits, do not have supernatural powers. In Harry Potter's world, it's the normal people who have the supernatural powers, right? Harry and Hermione and the gang. It's the muggles. You don't want to be a muggle. So you identify differently. It is not really lawful for you as a reader of Tolkien to imagine yourself as Elrond. It's beyond you. Tolkien constructs it that way. The best you can do, right, is imagine yourself as maybe Frodo or Sam, or if you're really ambitious, Aragorn. And if you're realistic, you're Boromir. But it's who you imagine, right? It's that moral imagination, who you identify with. Another difference, Tolkien's characters do magic, but you don't know how. You know how Gandalf does a fireball, right? He just does it. There's no explanation. Why? Because it's not licit for you to know. In the Harry Potter books, she very cleverly uses Latin derivations and will sometimes go on for a few paragraphs of exactly the mechanics of how the magic is done. So this creates a distinction in the imagination. One of the side effects of the Harry Potter craze was kids going to libraries trying to get books on occult, witchcraft, how to be a real wizard, how to do real magic. That's a very dangerous place to start going. One of the side effects of the Twilight craze was girls showing up in emergency rooms of hospitals with little chunks of flesh bitten out of their necks because my boyfriend just wanted to show me how much he loves me. And what is the archetype of a vampire? A blood-sucking, evil, undead creature who will turn you into one of its own and you will suffer, never dying, which means never living eternally. But now you have the coolest, suavest, most charming vegetarian vampire. So it's a twisting. What comes next? So anyway, this book, Landscape with Dragons, is, I think, a very useful to help you navigate this world of literature. There's more that could be said. If we had a bit more time, I would talk about a third book that I highly recommend. It's short, it's easy. It's one of the most beautiful little books I've ever read on literature. It's called The Mysteries of Life in Children's Literature by Mitchell Kalkpagian, and I put that on the bibliography there. And he talks about wishes and beauty and innocence and hospitality. And probably the most important thing that we learn from fairy tales and children's literature is the tremendous valuing of life. How many stories have started out? Once upon a time, there was a man and his wife, and what they wanted more than anything was a child. That story needs to be told again and again and again and again, because every child born in this country today at some point becomes very aware that they could have not been born. You cannot find anywhere in this country a six-year-old girl in particular, but probably any, who thinks it's a good idea to kill a baby inside a mother. That has to be programmed in. That has to be a disordered way of thinking that comes through every possible source to change a six-year-old who knows gut level that is absolutely evil into someone who would be willing to do that, or even worse, do it to someone else. We need to restore the moral imagination, and that is why this is such a great conference to have, where we can talk about it for a whole day. So thank you so very much. God bless you.